Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books, everybody. I am really, really looking forward to our conversation this evening with Susan Wells and this book, An Assassin in Utopia, the true story of a 19th century sex cult and a president's murder. You had me on 19th century sex cult. but once again, I'm embarrassed at things I did not know about history, including our 20th president, Garfield.
I thought sex hadn't actually been invented until the middle of the 20th century.
Holy moly, Batman. Well, if you had chance.
Gap in my knowledge, that's all.
That's Jamie talking, who's a wonderful last minute replacement for David, who's off doing something important. If you read this book, you needed to be in upstate New York in the early 1800s, Jamie, because that's where it was all going on. But in the meantime, before we get there, we have the award-winning Claude Jennings taking care of us. Mm-hmm. We have Jamie McIntyre filling in for David Aldridge. God bless David, wherever he is, something to do with basketball. And we have Judd Ashman, our favorite mayor. I have two guys from Gaithersburg. This is great. Welcome back, Judd.
It's the Gaithersburg Mafia.
It is the Gaithersburg Mafia.
I don't know if that works well with my mayor job, but yeah. I'll probably go with it for now.
Yeah, the mayor does have the button-down shirt with it open at the top, no tie.
I meant that in the nicest way, but maybe there isn't any nice connotation for mafia these days.
Oh, yeah. If you watch The Sopranos, there is. Okay, Judd, before we get to the Gaithersburg Book Festival, which is nigh upon us, days away, somewhere in the last week or so, and we just got to briefly mention it last week, Gaithersburg, Maryland, third largest city in Maryland, of which you are the proud mayor, the most diverse city in America?
In all of the United States of America. And this is, this study, which is put on by Wallet Hub, which is like a financial... Mm-hmm. advisory online. Yeah. They've been doing it for like 8 or 9 years, and Gaithersburg has always been top five. We have been top one before, but it's been a while, and we've wanted to get our title back, and so we've finally gotten our title back. It's very exciting.
Good. So how do they measure it?
Well, they have like a whole sort of pot of metrics that they stir in. So I was looking at this today. Socioeconomic, so that's income and educational attainment. Yeah. Cultural, which includes racial, linguistic, and birthplace diversity. Huh. Economic, which is like industry diversity, occupation, and worker class. Household diversity, which is marital yeah. status, age, household type, household size, and then religious diversity. So they stir all this into a pot, and Gaithersburg comes out on top.
Congratulations. We're proud to know you. Jamie is a long time. How long have you lived in Gaithersburg, Jamie McIntyre?
We moved here in 1977.
What caused you to move to Gaithersburg in 1977?
Well, we wanted to buy a house, and the housing prices in Alexandria were out of reach. And so we drove way, way, way out to 270 and landed in Montgomery Village, where we found a nice little two-bedroom townhouse that we could afford, and we've stayed ever since.
Nice.
Now, I don't want to scare people. It's not way, way out.
No. It seemed that way at the time. Now it's close in Montgomery Village and Gaithersburg is close in. At the time, well, you know, I've lived here long enough that I remember when 270 was 70S.
Yes. Oh, you are old.
And you had to drive and take the Beltway to 70S and take the rural interchange to get to the Shady Grove Music Fair, which was Theater in the Round right there at Shady Grove Road in 70S.
Yeah, actually, that's the first place that Bruce Springsteen played in the whole D.C. area was the Shady Grove Music Fair.
Get out. Why?
But it was before he was Bruce Springsteen. It was in his early days.
He was Bruce Springsteen then. way before.
Have I told my Bruce Springsteen story about his daughter?
No, tell us.
Okay, speaking of, we'll connect this back to horses. Then we'll go back to Gaithersburg. So his daughter is a very, very accomplished. She's ridden on the U.S. team, a very accomplished equestrian, huge jumps, go fast, Olympic level, et cetera. I think she was on a silver medal winning team. I don't know her, but a lot of people say she's very nice. But she operates at such a level, and they have a big place in New Jersey. They have a big place in Europe. And she operates at a level where it costs $4 or $5 million a month
yeah.
to keep her avocation going. And not too long ago, Bruce Springsteen was doing some interview. It was, you know, before he went on tour again or whatever. And whoever was interviewing very kindly said, you know, you're not a spring chicken. You really, what are you doing? Why are you out there working this hard on the road, these kinds of things? And he goes, y'all don't understand. He says, my daughter rides horses. I have to do this. And it's true. It's
yes. True. And now he's on this big tour. And now I know why.
Yeah. Now you know why. Again, I don't know her, but a lot of people say she's very nice. Okay. Gaithersburg Book Festival. Judd, are we what? 12 days away? I think we're. Yeah. 12 days away.
Yes. 12 days away. And it's really shaping up. So I'm starting to look at weather forecasts. We're not going to have 100 degrees. We may have a little bit of rain, but who knows? They could get that wrong. You know, we're 12 days away.
But you have tents. If you have tents, that's fine.
Everything, all the programming takes place under tents. Yeah. And all the book sales and book signings are in a building, and it's air conditioned. There's real bathrooms. So just so you guys know.
No, I should not make fun of how hot it was last year. Although it was hot. Because it is beautifully done. It's Boer Park in Gaithersburg. Parking's free, admission is free, but there are these huge tents, and every event with an author has a tent. The big indoor building for the book sales is lovely, absolutely lovely, staffed by many, many really, really nice people. But yet the lineup of authors is pretty incredible, including, I'm so happy to see, there are so many who have been on this show, on books, so many authors, so many authors we've had on who are moderating some of the events. What's changed the most over the time since you started this wonderful thing? What's changed the most? Because it's one of the premier book festivals in the country now, right?
Yeah, well, I like to think so. You know, at the beginning, there's little things about the program that have changed, and also our venue has changed. But for the most part, the flagship festival is the same thing. And what changes every year are the stories and the conversations that we have. I don't know, maybe Jamie, you know, there's one author we haven't talked about. It's not someone I'd regard as one of our bigger authors, but the story is really interesting. For the Patreon people, you can see the book cover here.
I've heard about this.
Yeah, this was, so Jamie, I don't think you were here, Tori, in D.C. in 77, were you?
No, not quite, almost.
No, Jamie, were you?
I grew up in the Washington area, so yes, I was. So I don't know if I was reading books yet. I'm not sure that was a skill I had acquired yet.
Well, do you remember the siege of Washington, D.C., this hostage situation that happened in 77? Actually, Marion Barry got shot. He was a city council member. He got shot in this situation. But it was.
Do I remember that? That was the first big story I covered. The,
is that right?
The Muslim siege of Washington at three different locations. I was a young news assistant at WTOP radio, and we were all over that story.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. And so one of the books we haven't talked about is this guy named Shehan Mufti, or I hope I'm not butchering that name.
No, I think that's right.
American Caliph, the true story of a Muslim mystic, a Hollywood epic, and the 1977 siege of Washington, D.C. This tells the entire story of this amazing event in D.C. where it's one of the largest hostage situations in American history, number one. Number two, it was this group that was, they were upset. It was sort of retribution for this the other sect of Black Islam had perpetrated an assassination on this sect, and they wanted revenge for that. They also wanted this movie that had portrayed the Prophet Muhammad, which is highly sacrilegious in their eyes. Yeah. They wanted that was going to premiere, and one of their demands was this movie would not premiere. So just this incredible story. I think for people in the DC area, Jamie, you and others like you, you're gonna want to be at this program and see this particular talk.
So when I was at WTOP and this was going on.
Was this before you inaccurately said Ronald Reagan was dead?
Yes. Long before then. I was still. But my editor, Mark Efron, told me to try to call the district building. It's now called the Wilson Building. It was called the district building. Call the district building and see if I can get through to one of the offices. And we have one of these, you know, directories that showed all the office numbers. And I called all the numbers. And I got this guy on the phone, Hamas Abdul Qalees. He was the leader of the Hanafi movement.
That was the guy.
And he was the guy, and I got him on the phone, and I said, would he talk to us on the radio? And he said, yes. And I put him through, and Jim Bohannon, I don't know if you remember Jim Bohannon, was the anchor on the air, and he interviewed him. And in the course of the interview, Jim Bohannon referred to the group as Black Muslims. And they were as Mayor Ashman has pointed out, they were a completely different sect. This infuriated them. And when they got off the air, one of the demands they issued was that Jim Bohannon go on TV and apologize for calling them Black Muslims. And we were at Broadcast House at 40th and Brandywine Streets in Northwest Washington then, and we were co-located with WTOP TV, Channel 9. And so we scrambled around and we got Jim Bohannon a jacket and tie, because that's how you had to dress if you went on TV. And he went on TV and made a correction about that in order to try to make sure that they didn't lose their temper and take some lives. But I'm sure there's a whole lot more in that book than I remember from my time there. But I was a young budding journalist at the time.
Wow. Okay. So Judd, that speaks to the diversity of authors at this event. And one of the things I don't talk about enough is the children's events. But having been there last year, that one of the greatest things for me to see was the number of children's events, incredibly well attended. And then the tent in which the books were, the used books were for sale. People were lined up, and a lot of young kids with their parents, sometimes not, lined up trying to get books, which was fabulous. Jean McManus checked in with me the other day, and I know you can't stay on top of every author, but she says a friend of hers, Jennifer O'Connell, has a book called Elephants Remember, and it's about a man who learns how to communicate.
She's coming.
Going to be there. Particularly difficult elephant. I love all things elephant, so I'm going to try to find that one. But one of the greatest things is I've been trading so many emails and texts with various Chatter on Books alums who are going to be there and what time they're going to be there, and we're going to try to meet up and things like that. It's fabulous.
Oh, that makes me so happy. That's awesome. That's really awesome. So really everybody is invited, and I appreciate the plug, Tori. It's wonderful. And please go to the website, GaithersburgBookFestival.org, and see the 135 or so authors that are going to be there. There's definitely someone that you know and love in there and others to discover.
And it's a beautiful place. Borough Park. I never at the previous location that had the train, right? Didn't the other place have the train? Yeah. But it's Borough Park. It's really lovely. Absolutely lovely. So
yeah, thank you.
We highly recommend it. Okay. Would you guys like to do, let's see, we got about 5 minutes till Susan Wells joins us. Would you like to do a really fun pop quiz, or would you like to talk about how there are no lit majors on college campuses anymore?
You always pop these quizzes. I have no idea what the... I can't study for them. I don't know what they are.
Well, Jamie, it wouldn't be a pop quiz.
Let's do the pop quiz. Come on, Jamie.
Boy. All right. Okay. This is really fun. David Alder is going to be sad that he's not here. So I have to give credit where credit's due. This was from The American Scholar. I have no idea what that is. I would have nothing to do with that topic. By a woman named Katie Daniels. And it's called, her piece is called Famous Authors with Surprising Day Jobs. So I think to make it easier, I'll give you the author's name and then you have to guess the day job. How about that? And this was a job they had where they actually, this is how they made some money before they became world famous authors.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Okay. You ready? Okay. Claude, keep score. Perfect. Don't you call Roberta in the room.
Just said in case I need help, she could just
Roberta
yell.
Roberta under the table, giving Jamie.
She's the smart one. And she's the one that went through school with straight A's, not me.
That's like the Rosie Ruiz of Chatter on Books, Jamie. Yes. Okay, Harper Lee.
Harper Lee.
Mm-hmm.
She was...
She's going to give us a multiple...
Oh, I'll give you hints. Choices.
No, I'll give you hints. Oh. She went to New York City after college because she had dreams of becoming a writer. But while she was there, she had this day job.
Was she an editor?
Nope. No, Toni Morrison. I won't do Toni Morrison. She was the only one who actually had anything to do with writing. She was an editor.
So I'm guessing she wasn't a writer for the Jack Parr show, because that wouldn't have been the right time. So when you go to New York and you're struggling, you do one of two things. You either work in a restaurant, or you model suits and coats.
Yeah, nice try. No, here's something. If you're old enough to remember this. You used to in DC, in Washington, DC, you used to have to go down to K Street to one of multiple offices on K Street, storefronts on K Street, and get something, get a paper something before you then went and.
All right. Claude knows. He was shaking his head.
Do you know passport Claude? Agent. Was she a passport agent?
Okay. Judd wins because that's close enough. She was an airline ticket person.
Yeah.
She worked for Eastern Airlines. Okay.
All right.
Okay. That would be Judd. No, half a point for Judd, zero for Jamie, one for Claude.
Yeah. I think these need to be multiple choice.
Yeah, no, I can't figure
now
out.
Now he says that. Now.
Okay. J.D. Salinger. This one's really interesting.
Oh, man.
And I don't know enough about all of his work, but he would later set Teddy, which is a short story from his collection, on this job that he had. It's pretty wild.
So
involves travel again, not an airline ticket person, but involves travel.
Right. I think it's pretty well known that J.D. Salinger was a train conductor. And the inspiration for the George Carlin role on Thomas the Tank Engine.
That would be a minus one for Jamie McIntyre, for Claude keeping track.
Judge of Pilot.
Again, Judd's getting half a point again, Claude, because that's pretty close. He was a cruise ship activities director.
I don't know. Maybe quarter point. I don't know if I should even take
that quarter point.
Well, we don't want the math too hard, Mr.
Okay.
Good point, Claude. Good point.
Oh, we got time. This is good. Okay, I never know how to pronounce his name. Vladimir Nabokov? Is that how you pronounce it, Lolita?
I always thought it was Nabokov, but I don't
know. Okay, Nabokov.
I don't know.
Okay. This is pretty wild. Any guesses?
He was an accountant, I'm pretty sure.
English teacher.
He was a tax accountant. I thought about taking my taxes to him once, but he was too old by that point.
He was too busy.
A chess master. He's got that chess master name.
No, it's pretty wild. He was a zoology research fellow in the 1940s. He curated the butterfly collection in the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard. Of course, in 1945, he actually came up with a hypothesis for the evolution of the Polyametes blues, the type of butterfly he studied. Only at Harvard could you study one type of butterfly.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to kick myself because I was on the verge of saying that, and I thought it would sound stupid if I said it. So I was going to say exactly that was what I was going to say.
There you go. Well, like
I should get a point for that.
It took until 2011 in which a team of scientists using gene sequencing technology discovered that a theory he had at the time was correct. That's pretty wild. Okay, last one. William Faulkner. This might be my favorite. He took this job after he dropped out of the University of Mississippi.
Yeah.
Really successful people always drop out of school.
He was a riverboat captain.
Cute, but no.
Oh.
And mailman was wrong, I take it.
What did you just say?
I said mailman.
What made you say mailman?
Oh, just a guess.
That's an excellent guess and good enough for a point because he dropped out of the University of Mississippi. His mentor got him a job as the university's postmaster.
Oh, yeah.
He soon earned a reputation as, quote, the damnedest postmaster the world has ever seen, end quote, possibly thanks to his habit of throwing out mail he deemed unimportant, reading during working hours, and spending the rest of his time on duty writing a book. His reply to a scathing review from the Mississippi Post Office Inspector shows that the feeling was mutual. Quote, I will be damned if I propose to be at the beck and call of every itinerant scoundrel who has 2 cents to invest in a postage stamp, he wrote in his, wait for it, resignation letter.
Awesome.
Well, I have to say, with the amount of junk mail we get, we would appreciate a postman who weeded out the stuff that was unimportant. I would appreciate that.
I think that's pretty good. You know, my friend Lewis Black, who's a comedian, once worked on baggage at an airline. Speaking of airlines, he has some great stories.
Oh, I bet.
Don't think that your checked bag ever gets anything but the worst treatment.
I mean, we know Lewis Black's got great stories. That's what he does. He's got great stories.
Great stories, exactly. And I think Susan Wells has joined us. Susan, are you there?
I am here.
Hello. Welcome to Chatter on Books.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. Where do we find you? It looks sunny and nice.
I am in Mill Valley, California, right across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco.
Nice. Well, thank you for joining us. Across the time, I never know if people go in the same order on your screens, but Claude Jennings is the most important person on the show. And Jamie McIntyre, close second. Judd Ashman, very, very important for lots of reasons, including
distant third.
But thank you so much for joining us. Susan, a good sign of how much I love a book is how many little stickies I have on it. There are many stickies on your book, An Assassin in Utopia. So thank you so much for being with us to talk about it. It's, I was saying at the start of the show, once again, when there's something to do with U.S. history, I go, I got a bad education. Because there was so much, I'm going to blame it on the schools I attended, not me. So much in there, I went, didn't know that. It was fascinating. But let's start out by talking about you. So everywhere I read interviews, I read about you, it says historian, author, journalist. Where were you when you were 5 years old? And did you want to be any one of those three things, or did you want to be something else?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. When I was 5 years old, and after I learned to read, I just decided I was going to read and write all my life. And that's what happened. Really? I went to school and I was an English and journalism major, added a history master's afterwards, but worked as an editor, worked as a journalist, worked as a writer of books. And, and I found this story and I had to write another one.
Okay. This is one of the rare authors we've ever had on the show, because we've had people who wanted to be astronauts, you know, people who wanted to be butterfly experts, but one of the few people actually knew at a young age. What was it when, if as far back as you can remember, what was it about writing that you loved?
Well, I remember exactly the day I learned how to read, and I just felt like every window in the world had just opened up.
Wow.
And I just wanted to read and read and read, and I loved to write, and I became the treasurer of every little committee I was on and perfected my handwriting. There was something about writing. There was something about reading. I think I learn best when I write. So I love to write, and I think this is partly why I love being a journalist, magazine journalist. I love writing about things I know nothing about because the process of learning it, I learn it much better when I'm writing about it.
And are you writing, I get so basic here, are you writing by hand? Do you write on a laptop now? How do you do it?
It all depends. Different books require different things for me. I have to say that if I'm really writing from an emotional place, I write by hand.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Jamie McIntyre, and then Judd, you too. But Jamie, when did you switch from, what was the writing process for you as a journalist? Because you used to go with those cute little spiral notebooks everywhere and take notes and stuff like that. And then you started recording. But
so the thing that comes to mind about, and the great thing about being, one of the great things about being a journalist is, as Susan says, you learn new things all the time. And of course, in my job, I learn something new every day. But, you know, you learn a lot just from reading. But when you're a journalist, you have to learn it to the point where you can explain it to somebody else, which is another level of internalizing the information. And so you do this day after day. You learn it enough about things you had no idea about so that you can explain it to somebody else and not seem stupid. And then days go by and more stuff sticks to your brain. And after a while, you begin to think, hey, I actually know a lot about this stuff. And that's really the great fun part about being a journalist. It's a constant learning experience about things that you want to know about. And also, as a journalist, you often have access to experts and people that average people don't. I mean, you can call up someone and say, I'm a reporter with CNN, or I'm writing a book. And they'll talk to you.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you all this stuff, and you get to learn it firsthand. So that's my
cool
comment.
Judd, is the actual act of writing is somehow important, cathartic to you? Or is it just
like it is? I was just thinking, as Susan said that, I haven't done a lot of longhand writing since before college. In college, I sort of switched over. Yeah. But I do find that if I want to commit something to memory, I take notes or I journal something, and it helps. For some reason, that act really helps.
Yeah. It's muscle memory. It's your hand is connected to your brain in a very different way than it is when you're typing on a keyboard. You don't really retain that stuff, but when you write it, your muscles in a way remember what you're writing.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And this is the point where we're supposed to lament the fact that cursive writing is not taught in schools anymore.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. It's like kids these days don't know how to address envelopes and mail them. I remember for years, God bless them, my three kids, and I love them to death and they're wonderful and they can do it on their own now. But for years, when I would try to get them to write thank you notes to my parents and other people, even when they were in college, I would send them an email and say, okay, I'm express mailing you an envelope and they're going to be envelopes and there were stamps on them. And here's how the left-hand corner is going to look and here's how the main part is terrible. Okay, Susan, we were going to talk so much about an Assassin Utopia, but you've written about two of my favorite things, the Titanic and Amelia Earhart. And another time we'll come back to Amelia Earhart, but the Titanic, what is the fascination? What is the incredible fascination with something that happened a long time ago? And by modern day standards, a lot of people died, but what is the continued never ending fascination with the Titanic?
You know, I thought a lot about this when I was writing the book and after I wrote the book, and certainly after James Cameron's movie came out. What is it about this story that rocks the world? And I think that the Titanic itself is a ship. Of course, it was supposed to be unsinkable. But the people who were on it reflected every level of society. And it was a profound moment of dreaming about the future. And then it sank. And the thing that, this is going to sound strange, I think, but when Princess Diana was killed, that same kind of gasping shock about her death was similar in a way, I think, about the way people think about the Titanic. Everybody could relate to Diana in some way. Yeah. And she was just this paragon. And then when she died, it was just this incredible loss. And I think the Titanic plays into the same sorts of things.
Okay, I'll take your point. And Judd and Jamie from Maryland, Claude, you're too young to know this, but there's a wonderful AAA ballpark nearby, Bowie Bay Sox, Bowie, Maryland. And we used to take our kids there when they were little because we didn't have a baseball here in town. And it's a great little stadium. And over in one area, they have this area for all the young kids to play. And they had an inflated slide, which was the back half of the Titanic. And the kids were, for those who can't see this on News Channel 8, Susan just looked horrified. They would climb up a little ladder in the back and then slide down the deck of the Titanic, which cracked me up to no end until a few years later, one of my sisters was in the Titanic musical on Broadway. And it wonderful in many ways, but I'll never forget, we're leaving and our kids were pretty little at the time. And my sister shoves in my hands all these cute little Titanic hats for the kids and cute little Titanic outfits. And I said, there's some amazing line about time plus tragedy equals humor, but man, it's turned into something else, which is amazing.
I'm not sure the Titanic has ever become a joke, honestly.
Oh, I don't know. There's a lot about moving deck chairs. There's a lot about moving deck chairs. How do you find your topics? This will be a good segue to an Assassin in Utopia. So Amelia Earhart, the Titanic. I mean, and you approach ground that has been covered before, which is incredibly brave of you. But how do you find your topics or do they find you?
Well, some of them find me and I find some of them. A Titanic found me. I was approached by someone, the chief counsel of RMST Inc., which owns the wreck of the Titanic.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
And they had been going out there and recovering artifacts. And there was a whole new history of the Titanic. And I thought, okay, yeah, I can write this book. It was the first book that brought the story up to date. Also, I was the first woman to write about it. And I focused not on the marine architecture of the ship, which many of the books have focused on before, but on the human experience. I mean, David McCullough said, history is human, and that is that is the history that I write. So, and then, of course, James Cameron's movie came out 3 months later, and we had a very good ride.
Yeah, nice ride. Okay, yes. Judd first, then Jamie. If they could put you in some incredibly safe submersible, and you could go all the way down and get very up close and personal with the Titanic, would you do it?
Oh, man. I'd want to do it. I'm not sure my wife would allow me to do it. that's really, but I'd want to do it. Like, if it could be demonstrated to me that this is a safe thing, I'd really want to try to do that. What do you think, Jamie?
Well, you know, when I was a Pentagon correspondent, I had a map in my office with all these little red dots on them that showed all the places I'd thrown up all over the world, because I'm very susceptible to motion sickness. So getting there would probably be a problem for me on the boat. But when I was on a submarine, I didn't really feel the motion. So it would be very cool. Of course, I've seen all the video. It's kind of ghostly and... but yeah, it sounds like it'd be really cool. And if I could get there without being on a boat on the ocean in rough weather.
We could helicopter you out to the bigger submarine and put you on the submersible.
Surprisingly, helicopters are also a mode of transportation that makes me go into reverse thruster mode.
In fact, hey, Susan, would you do it?
A little known fact about me, by the way, is I was the first civilian, as far as I know, to throw up on a V-22 Osprey. So I've got that going for me. Yeah.
Congratulations.
You know, Neil Armstrong, Chuck Yeager, we're all aviation pioneers.
Susan, would you do it to see the Titanic up close and personal?
I had the great honor of being invited to be the correspondent of the 1998 Titanic expedition. So I was out there. And I did throw up once, but I was promised a dive, and I was going to do it. I brought Depends because it's a very long dive, right? But we got hit by two hurricanes at the end, and we had to evacuate the site. But I have to say, that was absolutely one of the highlights of my life, that experience, being up there on the site.
That's so great. Okay, speaking of throwing up, so Ted Turner, Jamie, for whom you used to work.
Yes.
Great guy. Who everybody forgets this, but he won the America's Cup before he became and creator of CNN. God bless him, all these other things. He was the captain of the America's Cup and the first American team to win it in a long time. But long story short, reason's not worth explaining. I used to spend a lot of time with Ted, and I asked him about it, and he goes, oh, it was great and it was terrible. And I said, well, what was great and what was terrible? And he said half the time in the race, he would be on deck telling everybody to do whatever you do in those things. He says half the time I was throwing up because he gets violently, violently seasick. That was great. Okay, Susan, should we talk about your great book with all my blue stickies, An Assassin in Utopia?
Sure.
Tell us how you found this, which is about sex cults in New York and Greeley and all these famous people that's 6 degrees of separation. But how did you find this story?
I found this story when I was a graduate student in history. I read about the Oneida community and my jaw was scraping the floor. I could not believe what they were doing in Victorian America. And if they were doing it now, we would all be incredibly shocked and probably repulsed by what they were doing. But because I'm a writer, I had it in the back of my head that I wanted to write a book about the Oneida community, but I didn't want to write an academic book. I thought if I could find a crime committed by somebody in the Oneida community, I would have a way into the story. But the problem was I couldn't find a crime because as strange as their sexual practices were, they were considered pillars of their community and they never did anything wrong that was, you know, obviously illegal aside from, you know, the sexual stuff. Anyway, I was getting very frustrated and this was back in 2009 and the New York Times had recently put all of their archives online and literally as a last ditch effort, I thought, there was a minute chance that if a crime had been committed in upstate New York, where the Oneida community was, there was a minute chance that the New York Times would have reported on it. So I literally typed in Oneida community crime and I got an avalanche of hits. So many that I couldn't even focus on what they were about. And when I finally started to read them, it was a presidential assassination. And I just thought, okay, I've got, number one, I've got a book. Number two, this is a much bigger book than I ever expected to find, a much bigger crime than I ever expected to find. And I spent the next more than 12 years chasing it down.
Wow, that is stunning. Okay, so just to set the scene, tell us about what was going on. Jamie earlier in the show was saying, you know, Garfield at his time, who knew anybody was having sex? It's like, well, you had to be in upstate New York. So why was upstate New York such this hotbed of theology, as you've called it? Why there?
I think it was like the Berkeley of the time. And in fact, I think that antebellum America had a lot in common with the 1960s. It was a time of incredible social experimentation because the Revolutionary War had shattered political institutions, but also religious and social structures. And charismatic leaders filled the void with new experimental forms of living together. In fact, Ralph Waldo Emerson said at the time that every reading man has the draft of a new community in his pocket. I mean, that was the zeitgeist of the time. And the Oneida community was one of more than 70 utopian experiments that just popped up like mushrooms after the revolution and between the revolution and the Civil War. But the Oneida community was the most successful utopian experiment in American history. They lasted for more than 30 years. But sex was the core piece of this, because
I was just going to ask you to define successful. Was it duration of time or is what they did? But talk about the sex, because it was insane.
Well, I don't know how much you want me to talk about the sex, but I will say
it's a podcast. Everything you want.
Okay. Everything.
We're not regulated.
Mayor Judd
by the
Ashman is the Ashman is the only public official here. He can leave if he's, you know, in dicey.
So the United community had a religious context. It was considered a form of primitive Christianity. The guy who founded it, psychologists have a field day with this guy. His name was John Humphrey Noyes, because when he was growing up, he was absolutely terrified of women. So the only way he could cope with this and his incredible shyness and fear of judgment was to create his own community, build his own world, where he was in charge of everybody's sexuality and he had access to every woman he wanted. But it all went through him. And he was the only one who could not be judged, of course, because he considered himself God's messenger on earth.
A very well-educated man.
Yes, he went to Yale. He went to Andover Seminary. He was a trained lawyer, but he was too shy to perform in the courtroom. So he switched over to religion. In any case, within this religious context, sex was considered the most exquisite method of communing with God. And there were rules you had to abide. John Humphrey Noyes also invented the term free love. Put that out there.
So
okay?
Great. Who knew?
But love in the United community was not free, because you had to, it had to be in accordance with John Humphrey Noyes' rules. One of those rules was that men were not allowed to ejaculate. Now, that required training. And young girls in the Oneida community were trained and initiated by the older men, mostly by John Humphrey Noyes himself.
Yeah.
And the young boys in the Oneida community were trained by postmenopausal women. So it was a very interesting environment.
He had a plan. You might not have agreed with it, but he had a plan.
He did. Some people absolutely loved their time in the Oneida community, and others had a horrible time. So, there were two faces of this, but there was a very public face, because he believed in telling everybody what they were doing, because he thought it was going to attract members, which to a certain extent it did. A lot of people applied for membership because it was a great opportunity. And one of them, of course, was Charles Julius Guiteau, who ended up assassinating President Garfield.
So
kind of a loser in the community, right?
Yes. He was a loser.
Okay. We'll come back.
One of my favorite sayings, I use this all the time, is that all of us have gaps in our knowledge. No matter how well-read we are, and even if you have a PhD in history, there's something you don't know about. But I'm always shocked at all the things in our history of our country that somehow I grew up to this advanced age without knowing. And there's so much in this book that I didn't know about. And it's actually fascinating. And of course, on one level, it's, shocking about what was going on there, but on the other hand, it's not. It actually has all these sort of echoes with what's going on today. I mean, I think somebody in the New York Times Review pointed out the similarities between Sam Bankman-Fried, the FTX guy who's in trouble, who had relocated, and they had some sort of free love thing going on there, there's people today, there's a rise of polyamorous relationships where there's more than one person involved in the, it's You know, what is it? There's really nothing new under the sun. I joked that, you know, I thought sex was invented in the 20th century, but apparently it's been going on for a long time. People like sex. They like it.
This is, yeah, there's nothing new under the sun.
It's fun.
Yes. These stories repeat. But what was so intriguing and entertaining for me as I was pulling these threads through this tapestry for more than a dozen years was just the connections. And as you say, the history I didn't know. And I think of this as sort of misfit history. It's the offbeat underside of the American story. There are the traditional narratives. They don't go anywhere near this stuff. And to me, it's a history that's just incredibly interesting.
And I thought Oneida was just a silverware company. Which I guess it still is, right? I mean, didn't that originate with this group?
Yes, it did. The Oneida community in 1879 began to fall apart, and it evolved into the Oneida Silverware Company. Absolutely correct.
Yeah. They ran some very successful businesses. Okay, but let's talk about Guiteau. Let's transition to how we have an assassin in Utopia. He was kind of a loser or didn't do so well at Oneida, correct?
Correct. In fact, the women called him Get Out. Instead of Guiteau. That's one of the reasons he finally left the Oneida community in 1866.
Do you think if he stayed and he had been more successful, quote unquote, then he wouldn't have assassinated Garfield?
Well, you know, he was demented, and he had this outrageously inflated ego. And when he was at the Oneida community, he believed that he should take over for John Humphrey Noyes, who's the founder, and that he should become president of the United States. So who knows? I mean, if he'd actually been sexually successful in the Oneida community, what he would have imagined for himself. But he left the Oneida community because he was going to create, well, because he wasn't getting any sex, number one. But number two, he was going to create a religious newspaper like Horace Greeley's New York Tribune that was going to take over for all the pulpits in the world. I mean, there were no limits to his ego.
I just want to know, this was a totally true story, right? You didn't totally embellish this, you know, add some flourishes to make it a little bit. We're talking about, this is as factual as you can make it.
100% true.
Yeah. Read the footnotes.
But you can't make this stuff up, which is why I love history.
Yeah. Okay, just an aside, and then we got to get on. My son Charlie has, you know, there was always this theory, Adolf Hitler wanted to be an artist, and he applied to, I guess, the Vienna School of Art was the biggest thing in Europe, and they rejected him. My son Charlie's like, you know, whatever. And then Donald Trump really wanted an NFL team, and the NFL owners were smart enough to look at his numbers and said, we don't want you. So Charlie says, if the NFL owners had allowed him to have an NFL team, maybe he wouldn't have been president of the United States. So just something to think about. And maybe if Guiteau had been successful sexually, he would not have gone on.
So
go ahead.
Can I jump in, Tori?
Yeah, please.
So I actually had, I was familiar with this piece of history.
Really?
I read about this. It was in Sarah Vowell's Assassination Vacation, which is a terrific book, but it doesn't go nearly as deeply as Susan does. And I, you know, she jokes, I thought, well, about, you know, here's a guy who couldn't even get laid in a house of free love. and he's, you know, he comes across, Susan, in your book, kind of like a character out of, if you guys remember, A Confederacy of Dunces, this delusional character. But, you know, if you look at it through today's lens, and I'm not a psychologist, but it seems like he was on some sort of spectrum, and, you know, perhaps they didn't have the language for it then. But what do you think mental condition this guy was dealing with? Have you read anything about this or come up with a theory?
There's a great book called The Man Who Would Be Perfect about John Humphrey Noyes. And there's also, who's a psychologist, and there's a book about the trial of Guiteau also by a lawyer who gets into the insanity defense. I am not qualified as either a psychiatrist or a lawyer or any kind of person who can classify his dementia, but he was Looney Tunes, really. I mean, he was.
It definitely comes across.
He was definitely Looney Tunes. However, he was with it enough to, you know, one, I'm going to be president. Greeley's going to be president. Oh, okay, well, I've got to stop Garfield, and I need to kill him to stop the path he's on. It seems, Susan, and maybe you can share this with us a little bit, it seemed remarkably easy for him to decide to assassinate Garfield and then to do it.
Yeah.
And we're not giving anything away here because we know what happened, but can you speak to that a little bit? Because the details of the story, he got the gun and he practiced, are remarkable.
He was Looney Tunes, but he really was extremely smart.
Yeah.
And he planned. And there was also this belief that he was being inspired directly by God, which right. also John Humphrey Noyes believed that he was being yeah. inspired by directly by God. So this was a theme. Charles Guiteau, in some ways, I see him as a funhouse mirror reflection yeah. of the trends and the zeitgeist of the time. So whatever was happening, it was happening to him too, but it was distorted. Yeah. So between his intelligence and his belief in divine inspiration, that was his motivation to plan very carefully how to do this, how to execute. Yeah.
And to practice and to know exactly where to be. Okay, you just said something which made me think of this, and we will not have time on this show to do justice to it, but the 6 degrees of separation of people whose names we have heard that came intertwined in their lives, P.T. Barnum, Edson, the female doctor, I have heard about her before, but didn't know anything about her in their lives, were remarkable. Did you find these in the course of researching and writing this book, or did you know that they were part of this story?
No, I found them in the course of writing this book, and I was just absolutely flabbergasted by these connections. And I'll just call out Horace Greeley. I mean, the only thing I knew about him was that he supposedly said, "Go west, young right. man."
Yeah.
But he's really the linchpin of this story. He connects Oneida to the assassination because he was the idol of both John Humphrey Noyes and Charles Guiteau. They were obsessed with newspapers. Newspapers yeah. were the internet of the era, and he was the thought leader. He was the Steve Jobs. They all wanted to be like him. And yeah. and then when he actually ran for president in 1872, Guiteau campaigned for him with the expectation that Greeley would be so grateful to him that he would make him a minister to Austria or Chile. And that was the same expectation he had when he campaigned for James Garfield. But the other stuff about Greeley is just amazing because his best friend was P.T. Barnum. And that just sort of opened up a portrait of the era.
Yeah.
It's not just about the Oneida and the assassination.
The beginning of truly grassroots political campaigning. The stories of the things they orchestrated, from log cabins being built all over the country to massive balls that they would roll around from. That I've got two or three stickies on that. That's that in and of itself is worth reading the book. It was fantastic. Okay, a little bit quickly on poor Garfield, the accidental presidential candidate. He didn't want to be president, right?
Well, he did, but he didn't. You know, he didn't want to run for president. He always liked to run for office only by acclamation. He wanted people to drag him to the center of the room and say, okay, you have to be the congressman. You have to be the senator. Right. The president. He was a lovely guy. He was, you know, smart. He was beefy. He was studious, scholarly, but he was a backslapper. He loved women. Women loved him. He had affairs with, you know, very intelligent women, including a cross-dressing union spy. I will say,
if you're going to have an affair, you know, come on. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was a very attractive man. But he was also very insecure. He had grown up in poverty. And the thing is that I really don't think he had a vision or a passion for the presidency. He was the dark horse candidate.
Yeah.
He was literally drafted by the Republican Party in 1880 because they couldn't decide who was going to be yeah. the candidate. And so he was drafted and made the candidate by acclamation, but he didn't really know what he wanted to do when he was president.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of the issue, but he was only president for a brief time. He was inaugurated on March 4th and he was shot on July 2nd. And then he lingered for 10 or 11 weeks.
I didn't know that either. I didn't know the poor guy lingered. knew he'd been assassinated. Thank you, sixth grade history or whatever. But he, poor guy, hung on for a couple of months. At least they got him to his place in New Jersey that he liked. But okay, we can't keep you forever. Judd, you first, and then Jamie. Remaining questions for Susan?
Well, Susan, I guess my question is, why do we think utopian experiments lost their luster after the Civil War? What happened to utopia?
It sound pretty good to you, Judd?
I mean, Gaithersburg would be a great place for one, right? Susan, just so you know, that's where I'm mayor, and I'm the founder and chair of the Gaithersburg Book Festival. That's why I'm here. So anyway, go ahead.
I think it was after the Revolution and before the Civil War, it was the age of the individual where, you know, as I say, every reading man had a draft of a new community. Emerson also said every man can build his own world. After the Civil War, big companies started coming up, and it became less about the individual and more about, you know, industrialization and how you fit into this new society. And I just think the zeitgeist changed. But of course, then you have periods like the 1960s where they bloomed again. So I think this is a recurring theme in world history.
At some point, they rediscovered free love. That happened.
Yeah. I wonder when's the next one?
Or discount.
Wait, Jamie. Wait. When's the next one? Everybody
I hope it's not going to take me another 12 years. That's going to be a problem.
Okay, go ahead, Jamie. Sorry.
I was just going to say maybe free love or at least discounted love as far as I can tell. But
rental love.
So the thing that struck me about this is, you know, we think today that we're living in crazy times where people have, you know, whatever side of the political spectrum they're on, have crazy beliefs. But it seems like it was just ever thus. And so what parallels do you see between the events that take place in the 1800s in your book and what's going on today?
Well, I think the most shocking one to me was the election of 1876. And it's parallel to what happened on January 6th. I mean, it was, it's so similar. And it was even worse because they didn't decide who was going to be president until a couple of days before Inauguration Day.
Right.
I mean, there were militias gathering. People were afraid of another civil war. It was just.
There were alternate electors. Just like the election of, you know, and again, that's another chapter of history. That what I didn't learn in high school, college, or postgraduate.
Never.
Oh, it was only after I heard about that.
Yeah.
And it was a combination of 2000 and 2020 because, you know, the margins of victory were, you know, there were 100 votes that separated the two candidates in one of the states. I mean, it was, and they went back and they had to, you know, hand counted the ballots and they had everybody watching. But then it was possibly a template for what happened in 2020 with the double slates of electors.
Hey, Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
Okay, we are coming back next week with Cheryl Head. Judd, has Cheryl Head been at the Gaithersburg Book Festival?
No, not that I can remember.
She's from D.C., one of the many reasons I love her. But she's got Time's Undoing, which is a really amazing story. It is inspired by her real life story of a woman living today trying to find out how her great-grandfather got murdered in segregated Birmingham, Alabama, a fantastic book. So that's next week. In the meantime, everybody go out and buy the multiple blue-stickied An Assassin in Utopia, The True Story of a 19th Century Sex Cult and a President's Murder by Susan Wells. Susan, thank you so, so, so much for being with us. And seriously, hope you come back with the next one because it'll be fabulous. Judd, May 20th?
May 20th.
Within the DMV or essentially east of the Mississippi should come, correct?
Everyone is invited, free to attend, free to park. Join us. It's going to be awesome.
So it's like Oneida. Is that what you're saying?
It's like...
I didn't say free
the
love.
The Oneida of book festival.
The difference between free love and free parking, okay? Oh,
given the choice, these days I might go for the parking.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's so sad in the DMV, people would go for the free parking. Okay, yeah. Claude, thank you. Judd, Jamie, thank you so much. Everybody, thank you for listening. Stay well, and we will see you next week. Bye.